Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a new week. This is the Ruck Podcast. A special today, and thanks before we start for downloading us and making our numbers so big. We really appreciate it. And 3 or 4 weeks of the season to go, then we'll have a break, then we'll all be back for World Cup warm-up games and the World Cup. So almost, we're still steaming ahead at the moment. Our guest today, if he needs an introduction, well, you shouldn't be listening. He was described on Saturday evening as one of the two legends created by English rugby. Lawrence, when they said two, I looked up expectantly. I don't think it was me, though.
It was obviously a forward that came up with that, because the other one was Martin Johnson. So he appropriately, or rather inappropriately, forgot the other legends of English rugby, the likes of Johnny Wilkinson and Jason Robinson and many, many others. But no, listen, it was a great night.
It was a great night. And Lawrence, we normally give a list of achievements of our guests on the Ruck. This time it's quite easy. We're going to give the list of non-achievements. What Lawrence did not achieve was basically nothing. He did the World Cup of 15s and the 7s. He won the Heineken Cup twice, won the Premiership four times.
Five times as a title.
Five times.
Four as the Prem, yeah.
Yeah, was in really one of the great Wasps eras. Well, it was a British Lions winner in 97, plus the Sevens, as I said, so there's not much he didn't achieve. Rugby has special kinds of legends, though. On Saturday evening, after Lawrence had been working at Saracens for BT, he then drove what I reckon is about 150 miles to the Forest of Dean, which is not the easiest place to get to. Amazingly, didn't get lost, to a function at Lydney Rugby Club, and in aid of the breast cancer charity run by Polly Barnes, who is Wayne Barnes' wife. It was a brilliant night. Lawrence spoke brilliantly. There was anecdotes I'd never heard before. He posed for probably, 100 pictures, what should we say?
There was a few.
He signed a 1,000 books, and at the end he approached us with a gigantic tray of something I believe are called Jaeger bombs. And that really put a bit of a full stop on the night for some of us.
Well, it's what the millennials drink, Jonesy.
I think there might be. You tried to introduce us to us, but after about 20, I'd still hadn't twigged it.
Well, I think you became the Jaeger bomb champion that night, to be fair.
Well, I'd put a lot of effort into it. it was a great night. Just before we go on to pro rugby, it was a great night. And obviously to have you there, they were absolutely amazed. But does that remind us of the greatness of our local rugby clubs?
Well, I hope so, because, you know, the game is a game that for all of us has been about the bottom up, not the top down. You know, we're lucky enough to get to the top of rugby and play internationally for England. But, you know, for me, the journey started at grassroots, at Staines Rugby Club at the age of 7 or 8. And, you know, and they're, how can I say, they're pillars of the local community. You know, it used to be the church, the bank, the library, but, you know, those sort of things don't exist now. So, you know, rugby clubs are very much the heart and foundation of any local community. And in Lydney Rugby Club, you know, it's fantastic. They had a great weekend for breast cancer. Now I think they raised north of £25,000, which is an extraordinary number.
Lawrence, there's another big match this week. In its way, no more significant than Lydney, but Leinster and Saracens, the final of the Heineken European Cup. You've been there, but this, to me, has got the sense of a real massive game. Really massive.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the Heineken Champions Cup, the European Cup, whatever you want to call it, is probably one of the biggest games of rugby in the world, full stop. you know, and I include Test rugby in that as well. It's a competition that that everyone enjoys playing in, everyone enjoys watching, whether that be live or on TV, and the live experience is phenomenal. And yeah, it's the showpiece of our game in the Northern Hemisphere. Often the quality, well, more than often, the quality of the match itself is better and bigger than most Test matches. If you look at the two sides, we have Saracens and Leinster. We have the two very best club sides in Europe at the moment, in terms of their consistency and their quality. Packed full of Test players, mainly from England and in Saracens and Ireland in the case of Leinster, but also there's a sparkle of other quality Test players, you know, across the globe. You know, it's something we're really looking forward to. If you look at the two teams, both of them qualified imperiously. Saracens, without being beaten, and are without question the number one seeds this year. And Leinster, you know, going down only once to an interception try in the pool match against Toulouse. So I think for the first time in a long time, you can unquestionably say we have the two very best teams in Europe. There's lots of little subplots in the sense that Leinster beat Saracens in the quarterfinals in the Aviva last year. Leinster are the current champions of Europe. Saracens the current champions of England. So there's lots of motivation for both sides. I was in the Aviva Stadium to watch England for the first time in a very long time dismantle Ireland. And I'm not sure that Ireland or its players have quite recovered from that contest. You know, of course they've recovered physically, but I mean, if you look at their performances subsequently, they haven't quite hit the heights, because that really knocked the wind out of them. But Leinster have come back and proved that they have got what it takes to win. Leinster, of course, going for an unprecedented 5 European Cup final wins. That would eclipse even the great Toulouse sides of yesteryear. Saracens trying to be the first English club to win it 3 times. Of course, my own Wasps side and Leicester twice. So, you know, it's brilliant. You know, really looking forward to it. Very, very excited. Some of the best players in the world playing. And a unique stadium, St James's Park, capacity of 55,000. I was there for the World Cup to watch the All Blacks play there. I was there more recently to watch Gonover sort of putting his Shearer-like celebration.
Yeah, the Shearer salute,
Feels like a long eternity ago for Newcastle Falcons. But, you know, it's going to be a wonderful atmosphere, and I'm sure both sets of players will do it proud.
What do you make of Sarries? They seem to be the Marmite club. I mean, I actually got a great... It's very difficult because they've sort of magicked a club in Barnet out of thin air, because they were only a little tiny club. But they do have... We know there are issues with... They are fighting their own issues with allegations about the salary cap, which obviously we can't really go into that. But, I mean, do you like going to Allianz Park, and do you like what... Or do you admire what Saracens are doing?
Well, I think the challenge for all clubs is to take what was really good and strong from your core, from your fabric, if you like, as an amateur club. And Saracens were a club rather like my own, Wasps, that... Very working man-like, very humble beginnings in Southgate and then Watford. And, you know, their evolution has been extraordinary, really, if you think about it, as have many. And so I like the backstory of Saracens. I like Nigel Ray a lot, the owner. There's a lot that he's given to English rugby, both in terms of his heart and his soul and, you know, no small amount financially either. So... I think whether you like them or not, I think what Saracens have got is a rugby ethos at their heart. As they're a rugby club first and foremost, and they're a rugby club that look after their players, that try and nurture, grow and develop their players into something bigger and better. And my word, what a galaxy and what a arsenal of players they've accumulated. I mean, you know, as you said, we forget the financial implications, but they've got some of the best rugby talent on the planet at the moment, and they're making it better, and that's what's even more important. You know, they've got an incredible core of players, but if you look at the development of each and every one of those players, as a result of the coaching from whether that be Mark McCall, Alex Sanderson, or their S&C team or whatever, they have moved them on. Will Skelton. I keep calling him Nick Skelton. He's built like a horse. he doesn't ride one, but Will Skelton. I mean, look at how he's improved as a player since he's arrived at Saracens. Now, you know, you could argue if you look around your changing room and you've got Cruz, Itoji and Ezekwe, you know, you're going to have to improve just to get a game. But his progression has been phenomenal. Even players like Liam Williams, how they've improved since they've arrived there. So,
no question.
You know, I mean, I've got huge admiration for what they're doing. They are building a dynasty, a legacy. You know, I was lucky enough to be part of one that lasted for about 3 years, but Saracens have eclipsed that already in terms of what they're doing in this particular era. And for my mind, they're not just ahead of the pack, they're head and shoulders above the rest of everything in England. And I think this is a challenge that they need, really, this Leinster team, because other than Exeter, there's been very few that can hold a torch to them in the Premiership. So, you know, this is the thing that really excites them. And if you look at the game, I was there last Saturday for their outing against Exeter. They could afford to rest all their players, and you just saw the talent just watching the game. It's going to be fantastic. And credit to them, and credit to Nigel Ray.
I think, yeah, as you say, last week I met some of the guys who've been brought the academy players up, and they think definitely that the crop they got coming through now is you never know how it's going to work out, but they do think they've got their new team mapped out. You know,
yeah, so, I mean, look, I think they've got a core of wonderful players. You know, some that they've grown. I mean, success breeds success. So once you have that kind of success, everyone wants to join your club. But, you know, and look, don't make no mistake, they're still very good at cherry-picking the best, aren't they? They're taking Elliot Daly from Wasps. You know, they're taking Liam Williams from Wales. You know, they know how to, you know, they find a player that they want and they go get him.
Sure.
But equally, they add to that an incredible academy, and I saw some of those players playing firsthand. You know, I've been keeping a close eye on Ben Earl, who's going to be a superb player. He's a relatively limited experience at the minute, but there's certainly a side that are, you know, doing everything right at the minute.
Just we come back to the possibly give our own views on the game on the Heineken Cup final later, but of course you were involved in them and I still look back on those as sort of golden years of the Heineken Cup, and I always remember your 04 triumph, where that must have been people remember you playing Munster in an absolutely amazing semi-final when they were meant to be unbeatable. People remember the final against Toulouse, where actually Toulouse played wonderfully well in the final. But also, you know, you go back there, you had to go to Perpignan, who were now a second division team. Yeah. But I just remember that being as hard as any game you played, probably.
Yeah, it's about 29 sightings, which wasn't helpful.
There were only 27 of those were you, though,
were they? Yeah, well, I played 20 minutes in the second row, which wasn't part of the deal. But no, wonderful atmosphere. I mean, we were clapped off the field, standing ovation from 19,000 Perpignan supporters. So I think with that competition, I mean, listen, it's rich. I mean, it's the best, for me, it's the best competition in the world, bar none. And people often say to me, what's the highlight of your rugby career? And it would be easy to say, well, the British and Irish Lions and playing for England. But actually, week in, week out, playing with your mates for your club and getting to the top and doing it with them, you know, particularly because international rugby is something which some of us are lucky enough to experience. But to play at the top of the tree with your club mates is something very special. And that journey we had in 2003-04, you know, started with the World Cup for me in 03 at the end, and then finished with the Heineken Cup at the end of the season. And it, you know, sometimes your name is on the trophy, and for us to have to go to Lansdowne Road, as it was then, and play against Munster, the best atmosphere I've ever walked out into, 54,000 Munster fans, about a couple of hundred Wasps fans, and it was magnificent. And then, of course, we had a bit of luck because the final, you know, you don't pick where the final's going to be. It's there right from the start. You know, to end up back at Twickenham for an English club side like Wasps, and to be playing, you know, the Galacticos, the most famous rugby team of the European Cup, to lose was a great test for us. And you can't forget that Rob Howley try in the corner. You know, just a wonderful moment.
Your Wasps team, let's just talk about 04. You and I on Saturday evening were talking about leadership, and you know, people keep on saying, oh, we've got to have leaders. Eddie said we've got to have leaders for England, and I think, well, are leaders, are they really manufacturable, or are they just born? Now, that Wasps team, there was yourself, there was the likes of Shawzy, there was the likes of Josh Lucy, Fraser Waters. I mean, that those guys were born leaders. No one actually taught them to be leaders. They just were leaders. And was that one of your strengths?
Undoubtedly, but also the success for us as a group didn't come overnight. You know, I look at the Saracens team now, and you know, many of them are in their early 20s, you know, and they're winning European Cups and they're winning Premiership trophies, and good luck to them. You know, to be able to do that at that age is extraordinary. Maybe in the modern era you've got to be in a hurry because you never quite know how long your career is going to last. But certainly for the Wasps team, you know, we were very much towards the end of our careers, but we were very much in right in the sweet spot of being very experienced as a group. I mean, I played in countless European Cup campaigns and been beaten in the pool stages. I'd experienced losing at home to Brive in the quarterfinal at Loftus Road. You know, we'd lost to Northampton Saints up at Franklin's Gardens in a quarterfinal. So we'd had many many setbacks in the competition, and I think as a group we'd learnt on that journey. And you know, the alchemy of success is never just down to the players or the leadership group within the players. I always think that the alchemy for success is a sort of combination of being well coached and some wonderful players as well. And I've always felt that the best teams in rugby are coach-led, but player-driven, and by that I mean obviously you need the framework and the structure and the kind of vision to be set by a Warren Gatland, a Mark McCall, a Sir Clive Woodward, but you then need those players to take that and drive it home. And if you disagree, then you know it's healthy and good to disagree with your coach, and it's good for your coach because your coach will disagree with you, trust me, and he'll tell you the way it is. So there's nothing wrong with creating that pathway of being able to be challenged as a player, but also challenge as a player. And that's what leadership is for me, is about challenging your coach to say, yeah, I agree with that, but I don't agree with everything you've just said.
Should we look
at it slightly differently? And then and I think, yes, the hallmarks of any team is about having that leadership. And I think the challenge for Eddie Jones and for England and rugby generally is, you know, how does that leadership get developed? Because a lot of the young guys who are playing rugby now have come straight from school, they've gone straight into the rugby team, and through no fault of their own, they may not have necessarily had those experiences in life, outside of rugby, that maybe drive and nurture their decision making and their ability to think outside of that. So you've got to create that environment, you've got to develop your players in terms of leaders and try and develop that important character.
That's a great answer. The other Heineken Cup victory you had was very much different because you were playing one of your own role rivals in the final, which was Leicester, and that's remembered really for, I think, Leicester went in as favourites, as they often did when you played them in those finals, and they didn't do them a lot of good. But that is recalled as the day when you brought off two line-out plays at the front of the line, and that came off. But, I mean, there was more to it than that, because, again, possibly you weren't as great a side as you were in 04, but you're still a good side.
No, I mean, let's just deal with Leicester first. I mean, a great foe, great adversary, and a wonderful team, and coached that year by Pat Howard, I think, but they were certainly, they'd won multiple trophies, and I recollect from that game is 2 weeks previously we'd gone up to Welford Road and we'd been humbled as usual by about 30 or 40 points and been handed our backsides, and I remember walking around the pitch with the players and it was they were celebrating, obviously, as they do at the Tigers. And I was just saying, look, we're all hurting here. We're all very disappointed. But let's just bottle up this feeling and just remember it in a couple of weeks' time, because this is the same team as we're going to have to play. And clearly, what's the definition of insanity? If you keep doing the same things over and over again, they're not going to be successful, are they? So I think what we recognise is whatever we were doing against the Leicester Tigers, it wasn't working. You know, if we have to take them on in a certain way. So we had to be a little bit more cunning and a little bit more mischievous about the way we went about our work. And having a coach from New Zealand, it didn't take long to recognise that, Leon Holden. So we identified their strengths and turned them into a weakness, and we had a little sort of... tactical think about it, and we came up with a couple of plays. And there's one thing coming up with them, and there's another thing calling them in the midst of a battle at Twickenham. But as you say, to do it once was cheeky. To do it twice was probably a little bit naughty.
You and your job with BT, Lawrence, but also just for your love of rugby, you keep a very close eye on the Premiership, and work close with it, and you analyse it. In terms of the Premiership as a league, we'll come back to WASC in a minute. Where does it stand at the moment? Because there's always the debate about the trapdoor. It's been a rather bizarre season because two were right out ahead and all the rest could have beaten each other. Where do you think it stands?
I think, first of all, I'm a massive fan of the Premiership. I love it as a competition. I loved it as a player, and I love it even more as a supporter now. I think it has grown and developed, but I would argue that it hasn't grown and developed at the pace that I would like it to have grown and developed. And by that, I mean, I think there's massive potential for it to get bigger and bigger. And I'm sure that that's the reason why it's attracted outside investment, because they see the potential for it to get bigger. In terms of an actual rugby competition, you know, the game has gone through various cycles. Leicester were the dominant force for many years, winning multiple trophies, then Wasps, and now Saracens, you know. And I suppose, you know, does success come in cycles? Well, you know, if you look at the evidence of the Premiership, it clearly does. Mm. But at the moment, as a competition, you know, everyone says, oh, it's great because, you know, everyone can beat everyone. But the reality is, if everyone has their full side out, everyone can't beat everyone. You know, Saracens and Exeter are head and shoulders above everyone else because of the quality of their coaching, the quality of their squad, and the depth of their squad as well. So, you know, there are still improvements that could be made. You know, last season we saw four directors of rugby change hands. So four clubs weren't happy with their performance. And those four clubs, to lesser or greater extent, have made significant improvements or not. You know, Northampton have made big strides under Chris Boyd and continue to do so. You know, Paul Gustard with Harlequins has got them back to a competitive position. Mm. You know, so there's pros and cons. But as a competition, I think it's fantastic. But I do think that it has significant room to grow. I'm concerned that, you know, when we tune into the Six Nations, and I'm lucky enough to be involved in broadcasting that as part of a team, we have 9 million people that watch England v Wales, and then the following week with the same players and the same sport, you might only have 180,000 people watching Saracens against Wasps. You know, and that to me suggests there is a huge audience to go and engage with, to go and talk to, and to go and grab, really. So, you know, yes, I think the Premiership is a great competition, but I think we mustn't rest on our laurels and think that it's by any way captivated the whole of the world. We as rugby fans love it because we're rugby fans, but there are lots and lots of people out there who should be watching rugby who aren't watching it currently.
Sure. You talk about the Wheel of Fortune, or some clubs have their day, etc. But did we ever think that Leicester Tigers would be possibly one score? When they played Newcastle away, they could easily have lost that game. Did we ever think Leicester Tigers would be one score away from possibly going down? And whether we did or not, what do you think has happened to them with all the times you've seen them?
Well, I take no pleasure in talking about Leicester Tigers or Wasps or any side in this manner, because, you know, everyone thinks because I played for Wasps for 20 years that I'm smug and I revel in the fact that they're suffering. I don't at all.
They do think that, actually.
Well, no, I know, but that's not the case. I mean, I know, what people have to realise is that we're only enemies for 80 minutes every weekend. The rest of the time, we need each other, because without Leicester Tigers, without Wasps, without Saracens, without Exeter, there are no sporting rivalries. And I don't think rugby is big enough in this country yet to laugh at the demise of a great club like Leicester. And, you know, when I look at what's happened last season, they finished outside the top four for the first time in Premiership history, and they vowed as a group that would never happen again. Now this season they've gone from finishing outside the top four to looking like they're going to finish around about 10 or 11. So clearly, whatever they set out to do has failed spectacularly. Now you can look at a number of things. You can look at the people at the top, and I don't mean the coaching, because in Jordan Murphy, they've got a wonderful coach, they've got a wonderful Leicester man, but clearly he needs a bit of support around him. You know, the decisions that are being made above Jordan Murphy, you know, need a bit of need a bit of research and a bit of investigation. I don't know what's going on at that club in the sense of what their board are doing, but you do need to give the people the right structures. Their recruitment, I don't think, has necessarily matched their ambition in terms of where they think they are. And other sides have recruited. The landscape in rugby has changed. You know, players are prized away from clubs for different reasons now. And in the older professional era, you know, players would join the likes of Wasps and Leicester because of the success that we created and because of the platform that we gave them to become international players. Now, you know, they don't join Wasps and Leicester, they join Saracens or Exeter or other clubs. So I think we have to recognise that the rebuild of sides like Leicester might take a couple of years now. And you look at Manchester United at the moment, they're in a sort of similar situation where they've been so used to success, the fans have been so used to success. And I'm not sure that the fan, I mean, I talk to a lot of Leicester Tigers fans and they're not, you know, they understand that they're not at the very top table at the moment. But what I think they really get upset with is the gap.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've not just gone from being very good to being good. They've gone from being very good to being very poor. And they've got a bit of work to do, certainly over the summer, for sure.
I think that we can't, as a member of the WASP board, we can't ask you board secrets, but I think fans WASP fans would like your personal opinion on, you know, they're still up there, they're still somewhere near the top, but nothing like where they wanted to be. And it's been a very, very odd season.
Well, it's been a poor season. It's been a disaster if you look at it in terms of results. I mean, Wasps are a side that the, you know, I think they changed inconceivably from the old Wasps when the decision was made to move up to the Ricoh Arena. And that we all know the reasons why that decision was made from a business perspective. You know, Wasps were losing £3 million a year. And, you know, they had a tremendously successful, you know, debut season there. And if you look at their trajectory over the last 3 or 4 years, they've gone from nearly being relegated, like Leicester, to going all the way up to being 80 seconds away 2 years ago from being Premiership champions, but for one Nathan Hughes penalty. So, but every year for the last three, they finished in the top four playoffs. You know, this year they look like they're going to finish mid-table at best, and hopefully just about qualify for the Champions Cup. And so that, you'd argue, has been a big backward step. Now, there's been lots of reasons for that, and I'm not going to sit here and make excuse after excuse, but they've had a horrendous injury list, and injuries to what I'd call significant players as well. Jimmy Gopeth, you know, week before the start of the season.
That was the killer, wasn't
they
it?
They lost both their first choice scrum halves, Dan Robson and Joe Simpson, for large chunks. You know, Joe Launchbury has missed 3 months of the season through injury, and you've only got to be at the wreck on Sunday to realise that actually, when Joe Launchbury plays well, Wasps win. When Joe Launchbury doesn't play, he was substituted with 20 minutes to go, Wasps lose. So, you know, they're definitely there's definitely cracks developing, and they've got to rebuild that. You know, and as simple as that. They're losing some of their best players for lots of different reasons, not because it's not a good place to be, but because of, you know, money talks in the Premiership now, and Nathan Hughes is leaving Wasps for nearly double the salary, so, you know, good luck to him. And Elliot Daly, you know, recognises that he probably wants to win a few things, and he's not going to do that at Wasps in the next year or two. So, you know, he wants to move to Saracens, and good luck to him too. So there is an exodus of players. So Wasps are going to have to rebuild themselves in terms of their squad. But as you say, when things are going well, there's one or two games that you win that they lost this season, and they've lost games in the last few minutes. You know, when things aren't going so well, you tend to fall the other side of that. And I don't think there's a huge difference between Wasps and the other nine teams in the Premiership. I do think there is a big difference between them and the top two.
What about the cause célèbre in English rugby? Because your coach let Danny Cipriani go, and he played very well for Gloucester. I mean, not every selection you make can work out brilliantly, but that appears not to have worked out.
Well, I think if David Young had his time again, he'd absolutely want to keep hold of Danny Cipriani, however difficult he felt it was to manage him off the field. The benefits of what he delivered on the field, I mean, Wasps were spectacular when he was there, as were Sale before, as are Gloucester now. And, you know, I've always been one of these people that believes what makes rugby quite unique is it celebrates difference. What makes people different is what brings rugby together. It's always not been about having 15 people that are the same on a rugby field. It's about having people that are different. And Danny Cipriani undoubtedly brings a point of difference. There were factors that led to his departure from Wasps, which weren't within Wasps control. You know, he wasn't in the England picture. So his salary demands were higher than possibly Wasps wanted to pay, substantially higher. He then becomes very much part of the England picture. So his agent and his position changed dramatically. By which time Wasps have already signed Lima Sopawanga. You know, I mean, no hard feelings. You know, he's doing brilliantly for Gloucester. And actually, you know, I'm delighted that he's staying within English rugby, and he's decided to sign on the dotted line at Gloucester to extend his contract.
Just finally with Wasps, no one. Well, I pretend to understand the CVC deal, but actually I don't, and I don't know really what it involves. But with Wasps, they got the way they set up the club financially is quite complicated. Are you still, as you always have been, optimistic about the future?
I am optimistic, but I think we have a challenge as a club, as many do, about our identity. You know, are we a rugby club that also has a business that's attached to it, or are we a business that has a rugby club attached to it? And I think they're two very different things, and myself as a board member, I'm not running away from that as a fundamental issue. You know, I look at Saracens and they're a rugby club. You know, I look at Exeter and they're a rugby club, and there's a lot of benefits of Wasps moving to the Rico, and we've become part of a much bigger business. But what we mustn't lose sight of is our identity as a rugby club.
Because you've got a big hotel and you've got a railway station and all sorts.
And we've got a casino and we've got we've got conferencing and we've got, you know, and trust me, you know, the business model is unique and it's and it's the envy of a lot of other clubs, but it mustn't be at the cost of making the rugby club great and making it special and making it a place that people want to be. And, you know, I think, you know, you have to become attractive in different ways, because, you know, Wasps is, people used to want to be in London, and as a result of that, they'd be attracted to Wasps because Wasps was in London. You know, Wasps is not in London anymore, so there have to be different reasons why it's an attractive place to come and play.
But in terms of the people who come and watch, when Wasps are going well, it's almost like you look around and think, God, I can't believe it. Where have they all come from? Yeah. I mean, when you see the 30,000 there in the stadium, I mean, it does prove that there's a market for people to go along and watch them in the Midlands.
100%. And I think they've been embraced by the people of Coventry in the Midlands and Warwickshire, etc. And, you know, if I think about where Wasps were before they went to Coventry, they were losing £3 million a year. They were playing in front of barely 5,000 people in Adams Park Industrial Estate. Now, you know, they're not losing £3 million a year, and they own their own stadium, the Rico Arena, and they are playing in front of an average of about 16,000. So, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, that has been a big and positive move. What needs to happen now, though, is that the team needs to be able to stabilise. And what I don't like to see is these kind of fluctuations in the way that they're playing. You know, it's no good being in the top four one year and then being, you know, mid-table the next. You know, you want to continue to build and build and build. And I'm confident that that Wasps will continue to do that.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Lawrence, when you went into the media, when you retired, and actually even Moisés have been absolutely, you know, the sort of person you can't go and have a cup of tea till you've heard what you've got to say, whenever it may be. But I just got the impression there's nothing you told me that you would have a few years and then go back into the game, and I could have imagined you in many different roles. Did you kind of get so energised by the media that, or was there just no sort of avenue that you fancied to get back in?
It's an interesting question, because I felt at the end of my rugby career when I retired in 2008 that I'd given absolutely everything I could to playing, and I felt that if I stepped straight into life post-playing by moving into a coaching or managerial role that I would be compromised by having to give absolutely everything again. And I wasn't sure that I was quite ready for that, because getting to the very top, and a lot of sportsmen will recognise this, is, you know, I rang every last drop out of my rugby career that I possibly could. And it came at a vast sort of cost, you know, physically, emotionally, mentally, to me personally, and to a lot of people around me. And I felt I did, you know, it was my duty to just to take a step away from that. You know, and maybe I'm lucky enough to be in one of those positions where I can, you know, work in the media and enjoy that. And I don't for one second take that for granted. I absolutely love the role that I've played. But I'm not sure there's, once you take a step away from rugby, whether there's necessarily the pathway to jump straight back in again. You know, and I've often woken up in the morning and thought, you know, shouldn't I be involved in the cut and thrust of the Premiership or of international rugby? And I see some of my mates coaching and playing and working in places all over the world. And there is a part of me that feels, you know, that there's a role for you there somewhere. And why don't you get back into it? And I don't know whether once you've taken a few years out, you kind of get a little bit nervous it's not like I've been too far away from the game, you know, so I still got a rough idea of what happens at the breakdown, still got a rough idea of what's going on the pitch. But so, yeah, I mean, I guess now that my children are much older and they've, you know, virtually left home, you know, you sort of think to yourself, well, maybe I should step back in, because if I don't do it soon, then I probably never will do it. And I look at a lot of that team that played in 2003, and I look at what they're all doing now, and they've all gone on to achieve good and great things in varying degrees. But very few of them are actually operating at the coalface of coaching.
That's what I was going to ask you. That 2003 team was full of magnificent leaders, magnificent characters. If it wasn't, they wouldn't have won the World Cup. And you think, God, the knowledge there. But sometimes, I mean, I don't want to be nasty to Twickenham, but sometimes you look at Twickenham and think, where is the big rugby expertise there? I mean, the new chief exec who's coming in is not actually from rugby. And, you know, they had to one stage to go to like Stuart Lancaster, who, whether you think he was good or bad, was just a kind of Twickenham insider. Now, all these big names that you mentioned, is it significant that, or let me put it another way, surely there had to be a pathway to keep those guys in the game? In rugby?
Well, I think there's two ways that you can look at it, and they're probably both valid. The first is that all of us have got the option of doing what we want to do post-rugby, and none of us have put our hands up and said, I really want to coach or I really want to manage. One or two have tried in different... I mean, Dorian West has had a successful coaching career. Paul Grayson tried, you know, once or twice and decided maybe that wasn't for him. Martin Johnson, you know, was heavily involved, was manager of the England team, and it didn't work out. So, but you're right. I mean, none of us have put our hands up, but equally, there's a lot of IP, there's a lot of, you'd like to think, rugby experience, Rugby Now, Rugby Intelligence, which has not necessarily been nurtured or signposted towards those kind of roles. I mean, Richard Hill is the manager of the England team, and he has a role within Eddie Jones' setup. But over and above that, there's not that many of us that are doing that. And I think that there is a role for quite a few of those players. I mean, Johnny Wilkinson is working with Owen Farrell and George Ford, you know, doing what, you know, helping them with their mental side of their game and their kicking, and clearly that works. But there is a role for a number of the players, whether that be coaching, managing, you know, mentoring. It could even be on the commercial side, could be marketing the game, because whether you like it or not, those players could still market the game in a certain way. You know, if it was up to me, I'd have Martin Johnson as a selector of the England team. You know, as a non-coaching selector, just someone that you can, you know, run a few ideas off of, and, you know, in the same way as Grant Fox is a selector for the All Blacks. So I think there's lots of different roles. You know, Jason Leonard is involved on the sort of presidential admin committee side. He's just been named chairman of the British and Irish Lions, which is a fantastic appointment. So I'm all for getting more and more people involved from that era into the game in some way, shape or form. They're not all going to be coaches, but it would be a shame to waste some of that valuable IP.
And when you mentioned the IP, I mean, it's absolutely magnificent with some of those guys, and it is a great shame. Did you find it difficult? You were always quite a straight-spoken guy. Did you find it difficult to come off the field and start being critical of players? Because I think that the punters can see through it when someone is scared to be critical. But that you know, no one would accuse you of being that. Did you find it difficult?
It's never been in my nature to be overly critical publicly, because I don't think it necessarily serves too much of a purpose. Rest assured, for those people who have played with me and against me, you know, certainly in the right environment behind closed doors, you know, I'm very comfortable with, one, people, you know, digging me out and saying what I did and didn't do. And equally, you know, you have that very honest environment where and you have very honest conversations, because that's the only way you improve, is by being honest with each other. I've always had a sort of philosophy, which I hope I've stuck to when I work in the media, whether that be writing a column in the newspaper or whether it be saying something on the radio or saying something on TV. Do I feel it's a reflection of what I believe? Is it genuinely what I believe? But secondly, would I be able to say that to the person's face if they were standing here with me today? And if the answer is yes, then I've got no problem in saying that. The thing about when you're in the arena playing is that you often don't like to hear the truth. And sometimes I think there's a way of articulating it which can make it palatable, and there's a way of making it personal and a little bit, you know, a little bit vitriolic and nasty. And now I don't go down the latter. I just think, you know, if you can't handle criticism, then you're in the wrong sport and you're in the wrong place.
Good point.
But equally, you know, I was one of these players that when I played, I didn't need a former player like me to tell me whether I played well or not. I had my mum to do that. But yeah. I mean, if you pick up the newspaper sometimes and you think, oh, I've had a half decent game, and then you're singled out and you maybe given a 4 out of 10 by you, Jonesy, and you think, maybe I need to improve next week.
I never gave you a 4 out of 10. That's a blatant lie.
I should certainly hope I never gave you reason to.
No,
but do you know what I mean? I think that it's important to you can't pick up the papers and read about yourself when you've played really well, and not be prepared to pick up the papers and read about yourself when you've played really badly. But now, I know all these professional footballers and rugby players tell you, oh, I don't read the papers. Utter nonsense. Utter nonsense. You can't avoid it. You cannot avoid it now. So, you know, you've got to take the rough with the smooth, and you cannot celebrate success without celebrating failure as well.
You were explaining the other night that you had a champion, because whenever you were left out or not picked enough, your mother went to tell the England head coach who it would be.
Exactly. So I said, you know, it's easy telling me the bad news. Wait till you've got to tell my parents.
the game at the moment is fierce. It's relentless. It's tough. Okay, the rewards may be better, but there's always the possibility of career-ending injury. Say Enzo, your lad, had was offered a career in rugby that probably was going to take the same path as you. Would you love it to him to take part, or would you rather him go to be a someone in the city or something?
I think I'd love him to take part. It would be wrong of me to say no if, having followed that path myself and ignored all the worldly advice that I was given. So, you know, for me, you know, follow your dreams and go for it. And you know, if that's what you want to do, but all I would say is, you know, I'd obviously talk to him about how tough it is, and but don't play at it, don't mess around at it, because it's not a career to mess around with. Yeah. You know, give it everything you've got. And work hard to be the best player, the best person you can possibly be. And then, you know, you'll see very quickly whether it's a career that you want to continue to pursue. But please don't, you know, don't pay it lip service and say that, oh, you're a professional rugby player and not be professional.
Or it's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing. I think you have to be there. And I think, you know, look, if you end up being, you know, the star of the show or one of the stars of the show, then I think it's a career worth pursuing. Hmm. And you have to know in your own mind whether you're going to be that person. Hmm. Would I have continued my path in professional rugby if I was someone who sat on the bench more often than I started? Mm. Well, I'd have to work out whether it was me that was the reason I was on the bench, or whether it was someone else. I'm not sure I could have been a bit part player in professional rugby. You know, because I would have felt that I was my destiny lay elsewhere, doing another job. Mm. You know, whatever you do, you've got to get to the very top of what you do. And if you've done that and you can hold your hands up high and be proud, but I'm not sure whether professional rugby is a place that I would I'd like my son to be around if he was making up the numbers.
Sure.
I just want him to be either all or nothing, and you know, maybe that's wrong. I'm not sure that, you know, but it's I couldn't have handled, you know, one being part of a losing team, because I don't understand what's the point in being involved in sport if you're going to just lose every week.
Yeah.
You know, because life's pretty tough as it is, but you know, if you're going to lose every week, that's just change career, man, or just get winning.
On the subject of career, just coming to the end now, but last time you were on, you mentioned Dalalio Rugby Works, and basically we had a heck of a reaction to it. That's your means of taking up children who've been expelled from school. Yeah. And you know, these days you have to be pretty naughty to be expelled from school in many ways. Is there any, how's that going? And is there any, you were talking about possibly even getting some sort of link up with government?
Yeah, I mean, listen, rugby has been tremendously kind to me over many, many years. And when I retired in 2008, I felt a natural inclination to give back, because with success comes responsibility, and I obviously rugby was my way of doing that. And I started to look at the work that was being done with charities in the area of young and disadvantaged young kids, and there's not many charities working in that space because it's pretty tough. So I set up Rugby Works to work with young kids who are at most, they're not hard to reach because we know exactly where they are. They're in pupil referral units, but no one really cares about them. So it's almost been a part of society that's been forgotten. Just to throw a couple of numbers out there, 65% of everyone in prison has been excluded from school. Your chances of success in life once you're expelled or excluded are virtually non-existent, because no one has that support system and that structure. Most of the young kids who are in that situation have come from very chaotic backgrounds where there's been a history of physical, violent, all sorts of abuse. Most of them have got mental health issues. So rugby is the hook, and we take these young kids on a journey, and we get them into full-time employment from the age of 14 right the way up to 17. We're currently in over 75 schools around the country. And sadly, you know, 14 young people every day are excluded from school. So that number is not getting smaller, it's getting bigger. So what we need to do is we need to shine a light on that and use a sport like rugby, which is, it has this incredible, the incredible values of the sport, to help provide a system and a support system to help these young people turn their lives around.
But it'd be true to say that actually your success rate is extraordinarily high, isn't it?
Yeah, we're currently operating at 79%. So 79% of all the young kids that go through our program end up in what's called full-time sustained employment or education. So, you know, that is a phenomenal success rate. And that shows that the values of rugby, the sport of rugby, and it could be boxing, it could be any sport, to be honest with you, but the ability to use sport, and in this case rugby, to help young people onto a different pathway, onto a different set of behaviours and give them a different future is obviously working very, very well indeed.
As I said last time, everybody, just look up Rugby Works, Lawrence's Rugby Works on the internet and have a look at it and read it. It is some great heartwarming stories on there, some difficult ones as well. One more thing, Lawrence, before you go. I think we're going to have to say who we think might win on Saturday. We've got probably an unbelievably difficult one in Newcastle to work out. But well, take the pressure off you, but you don't need that. But I mean, I think Leinster, Saracens just about good enough to win a tough game.
Leinster are the champions, so you never discount the champions. And with the quality that they have in their team, certainly led and spearheaded by Johnny Sexton, I just feel the force is with Saracens at the moment. I think if you look at the way that they qualified, they have all their best players fit, the Vunipola brothers. So the fact that it's in England, the fact that it's at Newcastle, the fact that they're playing against the team that knocked them out of the competition in the quarterfinal stage, the hurt, the pain of last year's defeat will just be the tiny bit of extra that they need. I think it'll be close, but I do believe that Saracens have their destiny in their own hands, and it will take an almighty performance from Leinster. Not that they're not capable of that, but if they were to beat Saracens in England, then, wow, they truly would deserve to be crowned an unprecedented fifth European title. But I just think Saracens are legit. And if you look at the contest at the Aviva Stadium in Dublin earlier on in the year, and you look at the significant players that played significantly well in that game, they all came from Saracens.
Okay. The Ruck's back next week, but before that, Lawrence, thanks a million for coming in. I know from first hand how busy you are, but also how brilliantly you speak and how messianic you still are. So it was great to talk to you, and I think we ranged through quite a few points there. And thank God we didn't have to drink any Jaeger bombs.
My pleasure, thank you.
Lawrence Dallaglio, thank you. And we'll be back next week, Owen Slot, back to the normal day on Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.